from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on February 28, 2011. Jay Palmer was a software manager for a massive worldwide company called Infosys. Palmer had witnessed a practice of fraud inside his own company, and at first he went to managers, tried to figure it out and fix it, but he was pushed aside, essentially. So that February, he filed a whistleblower lawsuit. And still working for the company, Palmer returned to work on a Monday, the 28th, and found this message on his computer, quote, "Just leave. You're not wanted here. Hope your journey brings you death, stupid American." Well, Palmer did not back down. He spoke publicly about what Infosys was doing to break the laws and game the system. And while he described receiving multiple death threats, Palmer did what he felt he had to do ethically and morally. We're going to detail exactly what Infosys was doing wrong in just a moment. 5 years ago, the company finally had, I should say 5 months ago, the company finally had to concede some defeat, paying $34 million in a civil settlement after federal prosecutors declared that Infosys had committed systematic fraud and abuse, the largest payment ever in a case of its kind. Today, the whistleblower Jay Palmer is working to help other whistleblowers, and he's in Rochester to speak at RIT's Golisano Auditorium this afternoon. First, though, he's in studio for this hour on Connections alongside Dr. Ron Hira, the chair of the Department of Public Policy at RIT. Dr. Hira, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Evan.
And Jay, it's nice to have you here in person. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan, for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and let's get to the business of what's been going on here. If you don't know what Infosys is, they're sort of loosely described, Jay, as an Indian multinational provider of business consulting, information technology, and frankly, a huge outsourcing service company. Fair description there?
Yeah, that's a very fair description. I think about 175,000, 150 to 175,000 people worldwide. I think about a $35 billion market cap and revenues of about $8 billion a year.
Based in Bangalore, but 15 to 20,000 employees in this country, and you began working for Infosys when, Jay?
In August of 2009. I went through an interview process. I was hired immediately and then sent to Home Depot was the client that I was sent there.
Okay. And when did you realize something was wrong?
You know, I really did not realize anything was wrong until somewhere around I'd moved from Home Depot from that project and went to Baker Hughes, which was in Houston, Texas. So at that point in time, I really started to see we were bringing people in and out, and I actually had one of my workers come up to me in tears, and he was, probably in his mid-30s, and he was over here on a B-1 visa working, and we were charging for him.
Now, hold on a sec. Let's make sure we understand what a B-1 visa is. A B-1 visa is not designed to bring someone from a foreign country here to actually do work the way we would normally describe it. What's the purpose of a B-1 visa, Jay?
The normal person, and Dr. Hira can chime in as well, the normal purpose is to bring somebody over here for a meeting. Okay, they're an expert in an area, for example, an SAP software module, and they're over here just to consult in a sales role. They're not here to code software. But the biggest thing is they're not to be paid. They're not to be paid to actually perform work. And that's different from an H-1B. And an H-1B is applied for.
And so you had this company, you had Infosys, who wasn't a case of outsourcing jobs to India. They were bringing Indian workers here on a B-1 visa, which was, if they were actually bringing the workers here to work, they were doing that fraudulently, weren't they? I mean, did you realize then that looks like fraud?
I think I first started realizing it when I was asked to change the contracts, a time and material contract to a fixed price contract. Time and material is an hourly contract, and fixed price is for a sum of money you do X amount of work. Time and material, you got to list the people's name out and their hourly rate.
Okay. And so were you immediately uncomfortable with that?
Yeah, I was. You know, I did ask for help from some of my delivery managers, and, you know, they assured me that everything was okay. But, at this point in time, when I had somebody come up to me and say they were about to overstay their welcome, and this person was on an hourly rate. And
why was he in tears? What's going on?
Well, you know, first of all, he didn't really want to be here. His family was back in India. He actually knew it was not correct for him to be here on this type of visa.
I've been bound to the table too here, Jay. That's all right. Jay is a demonstrative speaker, and so here we are. And this is now, is this what you're describing there? Is this 2009 or 10 or so?
Yes, this is actually 2010. This is in the February March time frame of 2010.
Okay, and Is that moment that you described, and if you've seen Jay on TV before, CBS News or other places, he's described that moment. Was that the moment that things really started to click and change for you internally, that this has to stop or you've got to deal with this in some other way? What happened next?
Well, yeah, you know, it was really a crucial time in a lot of different areas because we were working with a client trying to deliver a product because, if you recall, that was the year that the big Gulf oil spill came out in the Gulf, and mm-hmm. Baker Hughes is a petroleum type based company, and we were trying to help them with their software. But and then I was scheduled to go to India in March for a meeting. So yeah, I really started putting two and two together at the time, and I'd contacted HR people, and HR people were, you know, really wanted me. They gave me the information that I wanted, but they were in fear of their jobs. So it really started to click at that point.
Why were they in fear of their jobs?
Because there was retaliation. There had been people have left the company because they have challenged policies. They challenged procedures. For example, if you're doing your job and you know something's wrong and you report it and you're scolded, you got a couple of choices. You keep after it or you leave. So people had actually left the company. And they were American people. They were American citizens. They would bring in people to do immigration jobs, you know, for example, HR, to make sure the visas were right, the letters were right, but they were eventually controlled by a staff over in India.
So you're watching this happen where they bring these workers in on B-1 visas, and I imagine the purpose is so they can undercut competitors, right, Jay? I
mean, oh, absolutely.
So the point is to save money on what you're paying workers. What were they paying these workers that they were bringing in from India?
That's, well, let me back up a minute.
Okay.
They were paying them in India.
They were paying them in India, okay.
Yes, so which was violating tax laws, American
okay.
tax laws.
Okay.
They were paying, just for example, the company was making anywhere from $80 to $110 an hour. The workers were being paid Indian wages.
And just to give you a sense, Evan, a typical wage in India for that kind of worker would be about $10,000 a year, so about $5 an hour. So they're billing out $80, $100 an hour. They're paying that worker $5 an hour back in India. And because they're on B-1 visas, these are explicitly visitor visas. These are not work visas. They're not allowed to even pay them in the U.S. for work, even though they're going out to do work.
Okay. So the company is undercutting competitors in this way. How many workers total were they bringing on B-1 visas and doing it this way with Jay? Did you know?
I did not know an exact number, but over the past 3 years in working with the federal government, I was never told a specific number, but we did some math, and I was basically have a range anywhere from 6,000 to 12,000 people over a three-year period.
We're talking to Jay Palmer, who you might have seen his name in the news in recent years. He's a whistleblower regarding the Infosys case, and we're getting not only inside the case, but why RIT wants him here today. Dr. Hira, you know, obviously you know Jay well now. How much were you aware of this case when it was progressing? And give me a sense for why you wanted to bring Jay here to RIT today.
Sure. So I saw Jay's case first published in some news reports in the New York Times mm-hmm. and Computer World and whatnot, and I actually reached out to Jay because this is an area that I work on, which is outsourcing offshoring as well as immigration policy and the visa issues. And then Jay and I started a correspondence over the last 3 years. I think he has a very compelling story, not only from a personal and a professional standpoint, but that have huge implications in terms of public policy, in immigration policy, but also in the way that he was mistreated by his company and that he was not protected through the whistleblower acts that the way he should have been.
And so now we're getting to that part of the story where Jay is challenging within his company to find out what's going on. It's becoming clear to you that the other people who did the same have left the company. They didn't blow the whistle, but like you said, if you push back and your supervisors scold you, your choice, you don't have a whole lot of choices unless you want to take it even higher. But you didn't do what other people did. You didn't just leave the company. What did you do then?
Well, you know, first thing I did was I talked about it to my immediate managers. And I want to back up a step and say that, well, I think really when it hit home with me when I was in India at meetings and we started talking about the share price, you know, the stock price and how we needed to beat our competitors and how, you know, we were complaining about we could not get the people. We didn't have enough people to do the work. And so, you know, my philosophy is we can hire these American people, or we can hire legal workers. Doesn't matter what race, doesn't matter who it is. We got these people in America, we can hire them. Mm-hmm. And that was never an option. It was never an option.
They never considered that.
Never considered it because of cost. So, you know, really it was discussed on how rotating the people in and out on the B-1 visitor visas. You know, the standard stays like 42 days.
But as illegal as this must have been, were they trying to be secretive in any way about this?
It goes back to they police themselves. Who's going to catch them? You know, come on, you write a letter, you say you come in for a meeting. Once you hit the states, your customer don't know what you're doing. You know, they know they're paying this person. They don't know what kind of visa they're on. You don't know if your workers out here are legal.
The enforcement mechanisms in many areas of immigration policy, but particularly in the high skill area, are all whistleblower driven. It's all complaint driven. And so unless someone like Jay is willing to step forward and put his neck on the line, Department of Labor is not looking into it. The Department of Homeland Security is not looking into it. They don't do regular audits or things like that that you would expect. I mean, this is why we pay taxes, right? We have audits and things like that. And so this is a really bad design in terms of the system. And it's sort of purposely designed that way. I'd also add one of the other compelling things about this is that Infosys is an iconic company.
Yes.
It's the number two Indian IT outsourcer. Its founder, Murthy, is held up in the pantheon of business leaders, just like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates are here. And Nandan Nilekani, one of the other CEOs, you know, coined the phrase, the world is flat, you know, that Tom Friedman book, The World is Flat. So this is not some fly-by-night company. They sell to companies like Home Depot, Harley-Davidson, Bank of America, and so on and so forth. So it's a really big deal. And if they're doing it, I think it's pretty clear that many of the other firms are doing similar kinds of things.
Yeah, violating – go ahead, Jay. I know you want to jump in with that.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like – you know, and a lot of people ask me questions, do you dislike Infosys? You know, I don't dislike the company. I have the utmost respect for Murthy. But when you have a company this size, you cannot monitor everybody. You cannot watch what every manager is doing. And, you know, and it was a sad day for me to know that everything was true. It really was sad because of what the company was built on, $250 in a garage. You know, and... you know, the workers, you know, the workers that I worked with, they gave their 100%, 120% to the companies. But there was a certain group of people in the company thought that they could not follow the law. You know, it's the old saying from the South, you know, one apple don't spill, you know, don't let one apple spoil the whole bunch.
Right.
But, you know, it's, you know, like Dr. Hira said, everybody's doing it. I mean, during this entire process, you could not imagine the amount of people reaching out to me telling me their company's doing the same thing. And, you know, it's really sad because, you know, there is a fraud fee that's built into the visas. And the fraud fee is 33% to Homeland Security, 33% to State Department, and 33% to labor. Well, you know, that 33% is to fund federal agents to investigate this from documenting the fraud benefit section. But there's still just not enough. I mean, when you're not being policed, it's just not enough.
And so, and we're going to talk more about the public policy implications of this, but I'll let you know because we've got our first caller on the line, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you have a question for Jay, a whistleblower in the Infosys case, or if you want to chime in here. So let's go. We'll take that first call, and then we'll get back to the story on where Jay went next with his complaints. But let's start with Bernard in Fairport. Thanks for calling, Bernard. Bernard, hold on. This is the first time you've ever called, and the phone is sort of a wacky connection. Is it our end or yours? Yeah, all right. So hold on, Bernard. I'm going to have to cut this call off now. Let's try to firm it back up and give us a call back. And again, there we go. If you want to jump in the conversation, please do 263-WXXI. We'll get Bernard back on here. Jay, let's pick up the story now. So this, as Ron says, this is a major, major company. You're not battling with a 100-employee small company. You know that how big this company is and how well-armed they will be legally. But you're seeing from within that these problems persist. Was there anybody around you, any colleagues saying to you, yes, you've got to do this? Or were they saying, are you crazy? You can't go up against them.
Actually, I had both sides of it. I did have a delivery manager that did tell me nothing's going to have it. Americans are stupid. American government's stupid. Then I had people from HR that were very supportive of me and gave me information. It really kind of armed me and educated me even more. But they weren't willing to, you know, step out in the manner that I did.
Okay. So what did you do next?
Yeah. So I was actually moved to another project.
Because you were complaining?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, it was two part.
Okay.
We had finished part of the deal, but it was very successful with Baker Hughes. Brought a lot of value to them. But, yeah, it was because I was complaining, and they were bringing more people in. So they shipped me off to another company called Heidrick & Struggles in Chicago. And that's when it really, really started to get ugly. I was pushing back. I was starting at being asked to sign welcome letters. And the welcome letters were just blatant lies, saying that somebody was coming here for a meeting, wasn't even in this right city, when they were actually coming here to code software for me.
All right. So this company was, again, if you're just joining us here, we're talking to Jay Palmer, a whistleblower in the Infosys case, a large immigration fraud case. And this company was, and the allegations were that they were bringing in workers on B-1 visas, which is supposed to be a foreign worker coming in for a meeting or some kind of a short event, not paid, and instead they were bringing in workers on this B-1 visa to come in and actually do work, as you say, do coding, etc. And now, even after you complain, they're telling you you've got to sign these letters that you knew were lies?
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. It's kind of like the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing, because when they moved me to a different part of the company that actually different delivery managers.
Okay.
So I had different people telling me what to do, and I'm thinking, really, you don't know what just happened over in the gas and petroleum area with me, or energy.
And did you sign the letters?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
That was, and the reason they wanted me to sign the letter was because the consulate started kicking letters back because they were being signed by Indian nationals, and they were being rejected. So they wanted Americans to sign them so it would look more legitimate. So I just couldn't sign them. It was a lie.
And what did you tell them?
I told them absolutely not. But not signing it.
Okay, and then what happens from there?
Oh, I'm not a team player. I'm not this. I'm not that. They sent someone over from India to talk to me about, you know, being more a team player, and it just was like, I'm not going to lie for you. And then I finally, when I was in Chicago, I made the call. I made the decision by myself to file an internal whistleblower complaint. I read the policy. And I followed it to the T. And I followed the Sarbanes-Oxley law to the T, and I reported it. But let me back up a step. I actually called the corporate counsel and told him what was going on, and he was appalled. And I told him I was going to file a whistleblower complaint. He told me to do it, that he'd take care of it, which didn't really sound right. How are you going to take care of it if it's an internal policy? It should never come to you.
Okay.
But it should. If you file a Sarbanes-Oxley complaint, it should go to a third party, and they should investigate it.
And let me bring in Dr. Hira too as well, because we've seen in the last decade a lot more emphasis on whistleblower cases, and companies are supposed to have mechanisms in place to make sure that you are protected if you want to file a complaint, right?
Yeah. So the Sarbanes-Oxley law is actually comes in the aftermath and in reaction to Enron,
right?
If you remember the Enron scandal, and there was a famous whistleblower in there, and so as part of the act, they put in specific provisions on how you handle whistleblowers. And so what Jay did in his complaints were following the act and then also the internal policies to a T. Obviously, as Jay's story sort of unfolds, you'll see that, in fact, he wasn't protected the way, at least the intent of Sarbanes and Oxley.
All right, let's get to that first caller. Bernard, you're back on the line. Thanks for calling, sir.
Yep. Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. I went through a similar situation back in the 90s in Hong Kong. I was a project manager, and I was bringing people in from India. And the company that I worked for, Digital Equipment, basically the similar thing. They wanted to pay them $5. But as the project manager, I had worked out the cost of the project, and I knew that was ridiculous. And I refused to do it. And it seems to me that to the other side of this is, you know, a whistleblower – to me, that's it's certainly a title that I think they use to basically break this person out as a separate person and maybe, you know, if you will, destroy his career, or basically, I think, create a situation where nobody wants to be a whistleblower. But it just seems strange to me that companies don't deal with this in a more practical ethical motive, in the sense that, you know, when you do a project, you've got to figure out how much money you're going to make, and you've got to pay the right price to the right people. And you don't want to get involved in these kinds of games. Unfortunately, again, with a lot of experience in the industry, I think this is very widespread. And I just really think that this is something that needs to be addressed. We shouldn't be separating people off as whistleblowers. We should be saying these are good workers, professional workers, and quote-unquote they're doing the right thing that makes business work over a long period of time. Because, you know, it's just really sad that somebody has to be a whistleblower to bring good ethics into business. Thank you very much for your call.
Now, Bernard, thank you. And I think there's a couple of prongs there. Let me start with the prong that says, why wouldn't companies want to do things above board? It seems to me, Jay and Ron, that if a company is behaving this way, they're taking a calculated risk that even if we get hit with a fine, it's worth it because, number one, we don't think we'll get caught. Number two, if we do, we're still making or saving a lot of money on employing foreign workers illegally. What do you think, Jay?
I think you're exactly right. It's the cost of doing business. I think the last report that CBS News did, John Miller, he said, you know, is I think that Charlie Rose asked him, is this just the cost of doing business? Well, you look at Emphasis, $34 million fine. Their profits, their quarterly profits are anywhere from $250 to $400 million a quarter. So
in our world, we see a $34 million fine, biggest fine ever in an immigration fraud case, and we think huge fine. But in reality, for them, they can absorb it. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
It's about 2% of their annual profits, not their revenue, annual profits. This is an extraordinarily profitable company, in part because they're playing these kinds of wage arbitrage games. And so the question really is the fine enough to change behavior?
Right. And in this case, it doesn't look like it, right?
Well, the only thing that would have changed behavior was some type of sanction or disbarment from the visa program. Mm-hmm. You hit companies where it hurts. The bottom line is hurt. But, you know, if you pay out, you know, if they would have paid out $300 million.
Okay. And by the way here, Bernard brought up another point that's important because Jay is a whistleblower. And if you're just joining us, Jay Palmer in studio with us was the whistleblower in the Infosys case, which I don't know if he knew it at the time. He's become a national figure. And you probably don't think these things step by step, but here we are. And Bernard's point about whistleblowers is they almost extract themselves from a mainstream company environment and you become – a bit of a pariah, whether you like it or not. Bernard's saying that's the way the system is set up, and it's sort of unfair to the whistleblower. But Dr. Hero, it's not supposed to be that way. You're supposed to be able to blow the whistle, be protected, and maintain a working relationship. Are we seeing whistleblowers protected enough that they are safe?
Well, I think Jay's case is a perfect example, right? So he remained employed with Infosys, but they isolated him, and he can tell you some of the stories and the kind of personal toll that took on him. The professional pride that was pulled away from him. And I could tell, you know, I had been in contact with Jay from 2011, and every time I talked to him, I could hear in his voice, you know, the pain that he was going through and the turmoil that he was going through along the way. So this is a huge personal toll. It's a huge personal risk, and it shouldn't be that way.
So, Jay, you initiate this action inside the company. When did it go outside of that? When did it become your lawsuit, and then when did we see federal investigation and other parts get involved?
You know, one of the things that I did was not hire, as I mentioned, I didn't hire an attorney for 6 months.
So for most of 2010, you did not have an attorney.
From March until December, I had no attorney.
Okay.
I reported it, I reported it internally, went back and forth. I actually got a letter from general counsel admitting, which is public record now, admitting to misuse of the B-1 visa program. But he was going to clean it. They were going to clean it up. But it was over his head. And it was systematic.
So they weren't telling you that you were wrong. They were saying, okay, but we're going to fix this.
Yeah, but still I was getting, you know, I was trying to make a lateral, I was trying to make a move in the company. I was blocked. Nobody wanted to work with me already because every different area within the company was doing the same thing. So, you know, I was somewhat blocked, and then it really, you know, it got structured around, it got to a point in December where I had to make a decision. Things were kind of bad. They were holding back bonus money from me and things that I'd earned.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I settled on an attorney, somebody that I would listen to me, and I made a choice to settle on somebody that I thought was extremely intelligent but didn't know a lot about immigration, because I wanted them to learn, and I wanted them to be there and learn with me and help me. But I also needed somebody that I knew what was coming. I knew I'd experienced it for the last 6 months. I knew it was going to be a long road. I didn't think it was going to be this long, but I thought it was going to be a long road. So we filed a lawsuit to protect my job in February, after, you know, February.
February 2011.
Yeah, and then my attorney had contacted an IRS agent. He's a pretty high-level person in the IRS, and, you know, I gave him permission to talk to this person, and this person, you know, put us in touch with some federal agents. And within days of this, the federal agent showed up in Montgomery, Alabama to talk to me. And I had put together a presentation. I had spreadsheets, and they were just at all at the information that I had. And then what I did was actually step back. I created a DVD, a video DVD, about an hour and a half of all the scheme, the fraud background, and I circulated it. And this was my attorney's idea. We circulated it to those federal people. We FedExed it to IRS, SEC, DOJ, and within days of getting that, the federal prosecutor out of Texas, because Emphasis headquarters is IT, their HR is in Plano, so the Eastern District of Texas investigator showed up, and then it really kind of spiraled from there, and then Senator Grassley got involved.
And to my view, all of a sudden, there were two sort of parallel tracks. There was your suit, and then there was the federal investigation, and then essentially that led to this $34 million settlement. But you lost your suit. And why did you think you lost that?
Well, let me back up a minute. There was something we did that was not public record.
Okay.
And actually, I'm saying this for the first time. It hadn't been said in any other publication or anything. I filed what they called a QTAM, a False Claim Act. And it was very clever. It was a reverse False Claim Act. So, you know, a standard False Claim Act is if somebody is selling the government a hammer for $150 and you're like, oh, that's wrong. You know, it's $150, the government should be paid that. So you get a portion, say the hammer's $10. So, you know, you subtract the $150 from the $10, $140 is what they cheated the government out of. But what I did was my... And it was filed under seal as what they call a QTAM, which means, and I believe it's Latin for in honor of the king. It's a Latin phrase, a legal term. What we filed was because they were using the wrong visas of bringing people in. So an H-1B, let's say it's 5,000. Let's say a B-1's 500. So they basically have not paid the government $4,500. So that's what we did. And that's what really, after we filed that, the federal agents, they all started coming in.
I'm way late for a break. Only about 10 minutes late for a break, Jay, because your story has me so wrapped up I lost track of the clock. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back, and then we'll pick up where we started the hour with the, you know, unfortunately, Jay did deal with things that were perceived as death threats and others, but how has it turned out for this whistleblower, and what's the lesson for others who might be in similar situations? That's next on Connections. You're listening to Connections with Evan Dawson on this Monday afternoon on member-supported public radio.
WXXI is proud to offer significant value to the organizations that support our programs and services. From nonprofit groups to local businesses, organizations large and small turn to WXXI Public Broadcasting to connect with desirable audiences, demonstrate corporate social responsibility, and generate community goodwill. To learn more about underwriting and sponsorship opportunities on WXXI radio and television, please email underwriting@wxxi.org.
Welcome back to Connections with Jay Palmer, who is in town today to talk to RIT at the Golisano Auditorium, and Dr. Ron Hira, who has become close with Jay over the last several years and wanted to bring Jay here. Dr. Hira is the chair of the Department of Public Policy at RIT. He's speaking at the Galison Auditorium when, Dr. Hira?
At 3 o'clock from 3 to 4:15, and we also have a panel of other faculty members who will try to put some context around it. So we've got some ethics professors, some business professors, and some engineering professors who will talk in response and have a discussion.
If you're just joining us, Jay worked for Infosys, which is an outsourcing company, and he was a software manager and realized that this very large company, based in Bangalore, India, but with 15,000 American employees, was bringing Indian workers over on B-1 visas. That's not supposed to be a paid job, and yet they were getting paid for jobs and making $10,000 annually, you said, Dr. Hira?
Yeah, that would be a typical, and I just correct, they actually don't have 15,000 American employees. They have 15,000 employees in America.
In the United States, yeah, I apologize.
Virtually all of them are on some work visa, so they're almost all foreign workers who are coming in.
And what Jay found out was that, what he observed was that they were bringing them over and essentially committing immigration fraud. They were paying workers very small wages, Indian workers, to come here on fraudulent circumstances. And Jay, within the company, tried to push back or at least find out what was happening and get it corrected. And the company pushed back at him. And then in February, you began your own legal action. I will ask you this, Jay. I know you've undoubtedly gone through a lot. I want you to share with us whatever is comfortable to share with us in terms of what you went through as a whistleblower, because part of your experience in helping other people in the future is going to be having to deal with the fact that it can be difficult. So whatever you're willing to tell us, we'd like to know, what did you go through when this was happening, February 2011 going forward?
You know, for somebody like me, who's, you know, been in technology for many years, who used to be a coder, you know, worked yourself up, being in front of people and working with people, the camaraderie, you know, I was on a plane every week, you know, for the last 15, 18 years. Mm-hmm. My friends were the people I worked with. You know, I was telling Ron when they brought what they call freshers over from India, you know, I was the person that helped them, you know, made sure they were okay. I'm the person that stood up in front of a room and talked to a room of 20 people to figure out requirements of the business in order to, you know, deliver a good, you know, services correctly. So I think one of the biggest tolls was all of a sudden I'm sitting at home and I'm staring at four walls. And, you know, the company, you know, it shut me off. Nobody talked to me. You know, everything became a whirlwind and I didn't have anything to lean on.
Were your colleagues ordered to ignore you, you think?
They were scared.
Because they knew what you were doing.
Actually, you know, that's a great question because during some depositions and interviews, I brought that up. I was like, you know, nobody will talk to me. You know, so they sent out this email, you know, talk to him. And, you know, I told Ron, one of my close friends, I'm not going to call his name, who was of Indian descent, kept calling me and talking to me, and he eventually got let go from the company. And, you know, at that point in time, I really kind of shut myself off from everybody because I didn't want them to experience some of the things that I did.
And you had a couple threats.
Yeah, you know, I did. You know, there was actually several more threats than were actually publicized. And, you're on a roller coaster. One minute, you know, you're extremely sad about it. The next minute, it's like, well, you know, come on. You know, come on to Alabama and do what you want to do, and let's see what happens. And, you know, I guess my biggest problem was I trusted the system so much. In a Sarbanes-Oxley complaint, they're supposed to protect you. But the first thing that Infosys did was go out and hire a criminal defense lawyer. First thing they did. And then he started threatening me. You know, I want your laptop. I want your information. I'm going to fire you. You're going to do this. I'm going to do that. And, you know, it's, you know, I got very emotional. I was hard to control. You know, I said things. My attorney would just, he would, you know, he was like, really? Really? You're going to say this to this man? I'm like, absolutely. You know?
You're saying you had a little bit of bravado in those moments?
I think what's the Spanish term, machismo?
Because you didn't want to be pushed around.
Well, it was not about pushing around. It was about, you know, it was about what was right and what was wrong. To me, it was black and white. It was, this is the law. This is what you're doing. And, you know.
But at that moment, are you realizing I could lose my career and lose everything here?
Well, I've lost my career. Even now, nobody will touch me with a 10-foot pole. I've applied at Cognizant, I've applied at Wipro, I've applied at HCL, I've applied at Deloitte, I've applied at I've applied at a ton of companies. Nobody, I don't even, my resume is very impeccable of my accomplishments. You know, when I went to India, I actually was recognized for being, that was my reward for becoming a good employee, was going to India to this meeting. And, and then here I am thrown aside. You know, they gave me this little plaque, a clock, and, and then next thing I know, I said, hey, this is wrong. Let's fix it. Let's hire some people, even if they're temporary contractors that are legal. Let's do it this way. And I had the cost associated with it. Actually, the company would have made more profit if they would have listened to me, and they didn't.
But if you would have known 3 years ago that you couldn't get work at other companies, that no one would touch you, would you have still gone forward with what you did?
Absolutely. And there are several, this was never really about, people are going to laugh, but it was never really about me. I did not know about the reward or the money or any of that until probably 5 or 6 months afterwards. We filed the lawsuit in Alabama to protect my job.
Okay.
That's what we did it for. And it was at the advice of some very high-ranking people for me to do that.
And you ended up losing on your suit. Why did you think that was? In fact, let me bring in Dr. Hero. Tell the audience about that and what your reaction was to his suit.
So he had a civil lawsuit in Alabama courts, and basically the judge dismissed it. And the way I read the judge's dismissal was Jay's being harassed, the company's behaving badly. But Alabama law is such that you basically have to be, somebody's got to cut you off at the knees, literally.
At-will employment.
That's right.
The way I read it too, Ron, was the judge was saying, there are some very troubling things here, but I'm not sure it gets to the standard where I can rule in Jay's favor. That doesn't mean we should all throw Infosys a parade. Well, what does Infosys do? They come out and say, hey, we've been vindicated, which was probably not a surprising reaction.
And not
but that's
only
not
that,
what the judge was saying.
And not only that, but that Jay Bomer is a liar, and so they, smeared his reputation and name in print publicly. And so, the other thing I would add, in terms of the criminal investigation that was going on, I would talk to Jay over the last few years, and he thought that the settlement was imminent, within, a couple of weeks. And this was 6 months, and then another 6 months, and then another 6 months. So that kind of uncertainty for Jay, took a huge toll on him, too, along the way. And I could tell every time I talked to him, the settlement's coming. And then 3 months later, it just hadn't happened.
So I want to chime in for a minute.
Yeah.
Everything Dr. Harris said is exactly right. What was really troubling is, and the way the laws are in Alabama is because a lot of foreign multinational companies came in, Hyundai, Mercedes, Honda, and built huge plants there. So they, Alabama legislator and Alabama law rewrote some of the at-will contract laws to encourage them to come in along with tax breaks. I have the utmost respect for Judge Myron Thompson. For his decision, I saw his point. The laws, the tort of it was filed under what they call a tort of outrage, and Infosys was extremely intelligent about it. The only thing that saved them was they still paid me my annual salary, and it was the best and worst thing that ever happened to me. The case being kicked out, it humbled me. It really humbled me a lot. From the government's perspective, it helped their case tremendously because, and I want to say the name right, Shabala, who was the CEO, stood up on, and it's on YouTube, he stood up and said, I told you we have not committed any visa fraud. We've done nothing wrong. And the federal agents and the government and the AUSA saw that, and they flipped. They literally... They knew what the government had. The government was very open with them. They had shared what they had, and
took it as almost a taunt from him, didn't they?
It was.
They? Yeah.
Here you are letting people go and firing people, and you got the nerve to stand up and say, we haven't done anything. You haven't done anything. And then it took a year for it to get over with, which was so many politics played into this, I can't say if this had any correlation or not, but Infosys went out and hired a lady named Ann Fudge, who's President Obama's friend, former cabinet member, and put her on the board of directors right when all of this started happening. Yeah, and so, you know, to me that was really, you know, an African-American woman on the board of an Indian company, and they really don't have any women in general in huge leadership roles in Indian companies. It's and Dr. Hira can chime in and tell me I'm wrong. But to me, it opened my eyes of how it's fixing to get really, really political. And I can't put any correlation between Ms. Fudge and this. I don't know her. But it was kind of ironic that this happened.
And so what he's describing, after that, we get this past October, we get this settlement, $34 million, Infosys has to pay, which certainly looks like a victory against them. The company is still going to claim that they have been wrongly accused, but it certainly looks like a victory against them. The trouble I have here, Jay and Dr. Hira, is you hear Jay's story, and how do you encourage future whistleblowers to trust that the system's going to work? I'm going to start with you, Jay, because now tell our audience what you're doing with your own business, if you could.
Yeah, you know, I'm really lost, and that's just being honest with you. I'm lost about where I go, what I do. I did form an LLC because during this process I had many whistleblowers come to me, ask for my advice.
People who hadn't yet blown the whistle but were in other companies seeing problems.
Yeah, systematic fraud.
And what were they asking you?
How, you know, what do I do? Is this illegal? And I'm not an attorney. How do I turn them in? And there's actually one case that just hit the news. And I will tell you that what I advise people is to keep your name out of it. You know, most whistleblowers don't work for a company any longer. You know, right after they blow the whistle, they're gone.
Yeah, that's sort of what Bernard's point was earlier, right?
But, you know, the person I'm talking to right now is, will never disclose their name. I will not even disclose their attorney. But I'm keeping their name out of it. And that's what I encourage them to do. And this is the story that hit Mu Sigma, that hit the AP on Friday. And I have been talking to other people. But, you know, what's amazing is if I was a company out there, knowing all the information that's been sent to me, I'd be a little nervous right now because all the information that's been sent to me about other companies, I've just turned it over to the federal people.
And so your company now, what's the name of the company that you've created?
It's J. Bennett, which is my middle name, Palmer, LLC, and it's just an immigration and whistleblower consulting. The website is jbpalmerllc.com. And, you know, really what I'm doing is trying to just educate people. You know, whether it's an attorney, whether it's a company, whether it's an individual, I'm just trying to educate them on really what to expect, what to do. But more than that, you know, if the government is coming after you, the federal investigators, and I explained this to Ron earlier, you know, they've got evidence because, an investigator can look at this, then he has to present it to an attorney general, an AUSA. And it only goes forward if that AUSA thinks that it's legitimate. You know, they just don't go after anybody. It's a process, and it's a long process to validate, to ensure that everything is there. But once that AUSA gets interested in the case, it's full-fledged ahead then. So if you get to that point, the worst thing you can do is what Infosys did. They hired a criminal defense lawyer, and they didn't cooperate. There's a lady named Valentine Brown, who's an attorney that wrote a great article on what not to do. You know, what Infosys did
and
wrong.
Your former company, yeah, step by step, that's what they did, huh?
Yeah, they. It's just, cooperation. If you have nothing to hide, why won't you cooperate?
But Dr. Hira, when you look at Jay's story, does that give you more or less confidence for future whistleblowers?
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think that'll be some of the discussion that we'll have this afternoon. But Jay was terrifically resourceful, very sharp, figured things out, plus he had an enormous amount of evidence already in his, in his possession, and he had the intestinal, the fortitude to go through with things. So I'm not sure. I mean, my experience with most whistleblowers is not positive in terms of the outcome for them.
Yeah.
And so I think this is where policy and policymakers need to step in to ensure that people like Jay and others are able to come forward and not be retaliated against and not lose their careers and not, be isolated for 3 years.
Or blacklisted from other companies, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't looking to do this, but, you know, I couldn't turn my head on it. And you know, one of the big reasons is because, you know, at one point there was well over 160 people that were here that we didn't know where they were.
Yeah, you know, we only have a few minutes left, but make this point. When Jay told me this before the interview started, this is almost mind-blowing that we don't think about in these terms. But when people come over on these visas, what happens, Jay?
So when you come in, you come through customs, they swipe your passport, and then you could disappear off the face of the earth.
You're gone.
Well, yeah. Basically, you could be. The only time you'll ever get caught, and this was a point that I tried to drive home when I talked to law enforcement in D.C. a few weeks ago, you only get caught if you leave the country and then try to come back in. That's it. So you could basically come over here and disappear. And Dr. Hira, is that correct?
Yeah, so the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, does not track people where they are and what they're doing and whether they've left or not. And so one of the largest shares, about half of the undocumented, don't come across the border illegally. They come in legally on a work visa or on a visitor visa, and then they overstay their visas.
And then, you know, you ask me, well, how do they work? Well, what they do is they'll work for another third-party mom-and-pop consulting company or staffing firm, and they're paid on a 1099 with a dummy Social Security number. So they're not paying taxes. They're, you know, taking jobs from legal citizens, and it's a never-ending cycle.
Got about 90 seconds left here. Do you have any regrets about the way you handled it, or would you do it differently in any way?
The only regret I have was my mental attitude and toward people. I became recluse. I became mean. I had a lot of self-pity for myself, and I was hard on people, and I took out frustrations, you know, on people. That's the only regret I have, that I did not handle the situation, you know, mentally as good as I could have.
And give me a sense now for what happens next with the case, because again, there was that October $34 million settlement, but it's not fully over yet. What's next?
So I think that, you know, if you read the complaint, I think the government left it, they did a great job in the complaint. I think they left it wide open where the IRS is, can pursue. I'm not really at liberty to speak about what the IRS is doing, but I have cooperated with them and I have cooperated with the SEC. So you fill in the blanks.
And Dr. Hira, from the outside, does it look like the immigration system, which is so rife with fraud, or at least the potential for fraud, are we learning enough from the Infosys case to see changes for the better in that department?
Well, we've learned a lot. I don't think there have been any real changes. There may be a little bit of change on the enforcement side, but Infosys exploits legal loopholes. So what's remarkable about this story is how much Infosys exploits legal loopholes that they actually went beyond that and committed fraud. And so this is very widespread across lots and lots of companies.
But we're learning. I mean, this is how, unfortunately, but this is the way we have to learn and change policy.
And Jay is courageous and has shed a new light on a lot of things that will help us moving forward.
See you this afternoon at Galassano Auditorium at RIT Wynn.
3 p.m.
Thanks very much, Dr. Hira, for bringing him here and for being here. Jay,
best
of luck to you. I know it hasn't been easy, but we appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right, we're coming right back on Connections. Changes to the SATs coming. Is it too late to save the relevance of the SATs? We explore all of that next.